Hi, Bobby here. Before we get into today's episode, I've got an exciting show to recommend from some friends of the pod. Lauren Mishcon and Nicole Goodman host Self Care Club, Wellness Road Tested, a show that tests out a whole range of self-care options so you don't have to. The idea of Self Care Club was born over coffee when they realised it had become another burden on the never-ending domestic to-do list so many women experience. This show turns that upside down by streamlining the process and empowering listeners to find pleasure and curiosity in looking after themselves. It's a refreshingly straightforward, no bullshit approach to self-care, so whether it's menstrual cups or couch to 5k, you name it, Lauren and Nicole are testing it. Just search Self Care Club in your podcast app of choice to join the ride. This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about bipolar disorder with Kima Bob. And first off, I've got a definition from Bipolar UK. It's defined as a severe mental health condition characterized by significant mood swings, including manic highs and depressive lows. The majority of individuals with bipolar experience alternating episodes of mania and depression. And I like that definition. One thing it doesn't highlight, which I think is a big part of the stigma and misunderstanding that can exist around this condition, usually, although there's different types of bipolar, usually it's several weeks at a high, several weeks at a low, or longer, but at least that kind of 2 to 3 sort of minimum, as opposed to cyclothymia, which is more so quicker highs and lows. And the other difference with that is people have hypomanias, which I don't know about you, but that terminology always annoys me slightly. Hypo and hyper sound so similar. Hypo is bigger, hypo is smaller. But yeah, so hypomanias are where it's not to the extreme as we'd think of bipolar. And perhaps that's part of why cyclothymia has those faster cycles, because it's not quite as extreme at the top. And we've had some past guests, including Grace Barrett, has experienced that, who was on the podcast previously talking about self-esteem, and will be coming back soon. And then one other thing that I've been reading up on, which I found really interesting, was different types of depression and how that links. Because one that used to be more commonly called unipolar, but nowadays is mostly called major depression. The reason why unipolar is sometimes used is because of the idea that it's got those periods of lows, you know, several weeks of lows coming back up, longer or shorter, but generally at least a few weeks. But it doesn't have the highs, it doesn't have the mania. So that's why major depression is sometimes called unipolar, which I found quite interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting and mind-boggling, isn't it? Like, I feel for any, for want of a better term, but for any clinician or anybody that's diagnosing, it's so difficult, and the impact it has on people who are experiencing these feelings and changes in mood, and, you know, and for those out there that are trying to get them help, whether that's professional, whether that's family and friends, you know, it's a complex illness.
For sure, and it's one that presents a lot of distinct problems, like the guest talks about there. It's a really tricky one to treat. It's one that's often misdiagnosed. Karen Manton, that we interviewed previously, had a depression and anxiety diagnosis for years before they figured out this is what she actually had. And that's very common that that misdiagnosis happens.
Yeah, very common. A friend of mine who has been unwell for 10 years before he even got any diagnosis, you know, and it was just so challenging to really kind of accept the diagnosis and its validity, really, when, you know, we know what medication, how that can change us and what that can do, you know, really difficult.
I think a lot of people can get quite distrustful if they've had the wrong diagnosis. There's no easy answer, particularly when often these diagnoses are happening in quite short sessions with a doctor when they're under a lot of pressure. If somebody's presenting very much in a high, high or a low, low, that can very much change what it looks like in terms of the symptoms on that day.
Absolutely. I was writing a paper the other day, and one of the areas that we were talking about were exactly that. The assessment tools that are used, you know, from literally questionnaires, you know, can be subjective. And you're right, when it comes to assessing and the assessment tools that are used, you know, to have at times some of the more traditional tools that are literally questionnaires. And how are you feeling? Do you feel like this? How often? When this happens, do you feel like this? We all kind of answer questions, don't we, with, well, it depends. Sometimes I feel like this, sometimes not so much. And when they are rigid in their responses and you don't have an opportunity for that in between.
It's true. It's very tricky. And, you know, there's a lot of conditions that can make that worse. If you're experiencing anxiety, that may really ramp up thoughts that a lot of us have of, you know, am I exaggerating my symptoms? You know, or the stigma tells you that you're making a big deal of it. You know, these issues can also really affect how you answer. And, you know, I've had that experience even with counselling, where my counsellor, when we started off, liked to every so often give me a questionnaire like that just to kind of check in and help her get more of a gauge of sort of where I was while she was getting to know me. And it's quite tricky for me. Because it's like, oh, I kind of wanted to see the previous form. I might feel like I'm a 7 out of 10 in mood today, but what do I normally answer? This stuff is so subjective. And, you know, I know that from my own experience where I mentioned to you that I was first diagnosed with situational depression relating to what was going on in my life at that time. And I can completely see why, because I came in the room and I was going through a really stressful life period, and I talked a lot about that and, you know, wanting to get out of that situation that was making my depression a lot worse. But it was only when I made some changes and kind of was able to look back at it more and accept my diagnosis more, I was able to see, well, no, the depression happened before this situation and it's still with me now. And so now I've got persistent depression disorder, which is one where it goes on for at least 2 years is the main qualifier of that one.
Interesting, you're right. It wasn't initially that the situation was causing your depression. It was just making it having an impact on it and making it worse to the point where you had to seek help because it's now become really obvious and it's really a problem. But it's not that it's caused by the situation that I'm in. It's just the fact that now that's really brought it to our attention. Yeah.
But I guess, you know, all I can say for that is, you know, this is why it's good to see a doctor or other mental health professional regularly, because otherwise I might be beating myself up thinking, oh, well, I've changed that now. I should be over it. Why am I still feeling this way? But, you know, with some of the support, it helped me see, okay, this is something a bit longer term for me. So some quick stats. So like we've been saying, it's often a very misunderstood condition, and it's way too common to be this misunderstood, if that makes sense. At least I feel. So 1.3 million people are estimated to have bipolar, according to Bipolar UK. And that is equivalent to 1 in 50 people. Plus, there's recent research suggesting that as much as 5% of us are on the bipolar spectrum. So for those of you counting, that would be 1 in 20. And it just shows you how common that can be. I also find it interesting, that idea of it being called a bipolar spectrum. I've not heard that before.
Yeah, I have. That's where then the statistic will come from, the 5%, you know, because that's a massive stat.
It really is. And I'd be interested to hear from the listeners, if any of you want to send me a DM, how you feel about the idea of it being referred to as a spectrum. Next up then, from the Mental Health Foundation, something that definitely needs a lot more research is they report that in 2014, younger people were found to be more likely to have bipolar than older people. So that's 3.4% of 16 to 24 year olds screened positive, but only 0.4% of 65 to 74 year olds.
Interesting.
And unfortunately, there aren't really many answers yet on why that is the case. I don't think, from what I've looked at, it's going to be as simple as you grow out of it. I don't think anything's ever that simple. But, you know, there may be a range of factors of perhaps as you get older, certain turbulence. It may be to do with when you're in that first range, your brain's still developing at a quite fundamental level up until you're 25. So could it be that we're still settling in terms of our emotions if we look at it from a brain science point of view? It's really difficult to know. And unfortunately, there is not enough research. And it's also very difficult to know how much of that could be that people's symptoms have decreased over time, or they've got better at managing it, or life factors have got better for them, and they perhaps still have symptoms, but not to the extent of diagnosis. You know, as opposed to this idea, like, you know, I'm very against of, okay, you're cured now. I don't know if it's that simple in most cases. But yeah, interesting. And something that it's a change of thought on, because previously this was seen as very much a permanent diagnosis. And it's only in the last few years that's being really questioned as to whether or not this is quite as permanent as people thought. And so I'm really delighted to have today's guest on to talk about this, Kima Bob, who is an incredible comedian, one of my favourites. If you're listening to a lot of podcasts, you've probably recognised her distinctive voice before, in particular The Guilty Feminist. She was a co-host for a bit, really talks very openly about her experience of bipolar, including being hospitalised at one point in Texas, where she's from. And so it's a really interesting conversation in terms of what that was like, some of the differences between the medical system over there to here in the UK, where she now lives. And just, yeah, quite a fun conversation, as you'd imagine, with a comedian, even though it's a serious topic. And I don't know if I've mentioned this yet, but given how popular Felicity Ward's episode is and how people are responding to certain other guests we're getting on, like Lynette Charity, who also does comedy, I'm now trying to schedule in at least one person with a comedy background every month. And so hopefully that adds another element, a bit of humour in what can be so many very serious topics. And I love to meet comedians as well. Not entirely selfless.
They're your faves, I think, comedian.
I love them. I find comedians fascinating. It's such a career where you can't quite separate, I find, the artist from the art in a way that is very intriguing to me. And I think, to an extent, maybe that's why so many of them do talk about their mental health, because it's like, well, if your process for making your art is taking in life and distilling your experiences down into jokes, then if you're experiencing mental ill health, a lot of that probably will get in there. So yeah, hopefully, listeners, you enjoy this episode. If you have any comedians you know of that speak very eloquently about mental health, you want to put them forward, let us know. But other than that, enjoy this episode with Kima Bob. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Kima, and one of my earliest experiences with mental health would probably be when I was a kid staying with my aunt and my grandmother while my mom was in a mental hospital, and not really knowing what any of that meant, but just knowing that she was somewhere getting help and I was not with her.
And do you remember what was explained to you? Like, was that language used at the time that she was in a mental hospital, or did you get a kid version?
I don't recall there being a kid version. My family is not really kid version people. I don't remember how I was told. I just know that I knew. And I don't remember a lot of the feelings around that time. Like, my childhood is, like everyone's, a bit complicated, you know, semi-unpacked. But there was a lot going on, and I actually don't have a lot of strong memories from the time. I mostly remember things happening around me and me just kind of being there, a witness. But I don't ever really remember. I know that people cared about my well-being and my health, but I don't remember anyone prioritizing how I was feeling about things. But this was one of my, I think, earliest memories of mental health being a thing or a factor. My mom was not always okay. You know, people are not always okay.
And that can be, I think, a very powerful thing to learn as a young person. I think so many of us are very shielded from mental ill health even existing, oftentimes until we're faced with it in ourselves. And then it's like, oh, it might have been nice to get some warning about this.
Yeah.
But when I've heard you talk about your experiences growing up, it sounds like your mum was a very big presence in your household, and at times things were too much about her. And so maybe that's part of why you felt like you were on the sidelines observing a lot.
I would say so for sure. I think that my parents, in many ways, they didn't know how to be that. They didn't know how to be parents. They were young. My mom was 21, 22 when she had me, and my dad was a few years older than that. I am going to be 27 in a couple weeks, and the idea of me having a child is hilarious, let alone that child being like five at this time in my life. So I honestly can't even imagine what that was like. And to fall out with your partner, to fall out with the person you're supposed to be co-parenting with, to not have that kind of support. I think that a lot of the time they were so frustrated with each other that I was kind of an afterthought. And I think that that's a weird place to be. So yeah, it did feel like a lot was happening around me, and sometimes even about me. That to me feels like part of why, you know, have looked to do things like comedy, or why self-expression is such a big deal to me, is at the time I don't think that I felt heard or seen really.
I get that. And it's interesting what you said about trying to imagine yourself in that position, because I think that's a really mature way of looking at it. And it's funny because it's very similar to me of looking around at my life and the life of my friends and thinking, yeah, we're not ready for kids yet. And I actually wonder with our generation, if there will be a lot less of us having kids.
Yeah, I personally, it's not my menu of desires or priorities. I paused for a second because my brain wanted to insert the word immediate, which maybe that's my subconscious being like, but I don't know. I've previously felt like it's something I didn't want at all. And now I feel like it's something I'm open to, but that I'm not really trying to be a part of for the next 7 to 10 years. I'd like to be like a mature mom. Like, I'm going to be like, I'm like 40. My kid is like 3. I've accomplished so much in my life. And now I'm in a great place to, you know, move into this next chapter or whatever the fuck. Like, I would love to be like an old mom. Because having a young mom is complicated.
It's interesting, actually. A lot of people don't know this about me, but I not only plan to adopt one day, but I have a very specific idea in my head, because I think there's a lot of the earlier stages of child rearing that I don't think I'd be that great at. I neither have the experience of changing nappies, nor the inclination to be, let's be honest, open to doing that at all. But I think I could really shine with teens. Like, I connect with older kids a lot easier. And so, you know, I would look to adopt a kid that's a bit older. And whilst this isn't the reason, a nice byproduct of that would be I can kind of catch up. So I can then, like, suddenly my kid is as old as all my friends' kids, but I've started way later.
I love this. It's giving me strategy. It's giving me vision, okay? It's giving me a plan. I love it. I feel it. I'm with it. Good luck.
But I wonder if even that is like a generational difference, right? That at times it feels like a lot are almost over-planning. And on one hand, it's really great that we're focusing on our mental health and our personal growth so much. But it's interesting to look back at my parents' generation and think so many people got into a relationship whilst their lives were messy and they figured it out together. And now that seems to be less of an option, that we're more self-aware. That's really good. But sometimes it gets to a point where we want to be perfect before we get into a relationship, which also isn't healthy.
Yeah, it's true. I think the balance is so hard, and I think it's something that's never really achieved. I think balance is an ongoing activity, you know? It's an action rather than a state, I feel, because it is hard, and I think sometimes you can tip too hard this way or tip too hard that way. I spent a while not being critical in relationships and love, and not looking at myself and looking at the person, but just enjoying the feeling of the thing. And it's gotten me nowhere. So I'm over it. And I am trying to be a bit more almost methodical, which I don't know if that is, you know, swinging too hard in the opposite direction. But there's just a lot to do in this world and in this life. There's a lot that I'd like to do. And I have seen and I believe that merging or whatever with the wrong kind of person or with a destructive person can really fuck that up for me. And I don't want that.
No, I get that. And I think it's maybe fair to say that the way you grew up with your mum being so the center of attention a lot of the time, maybe you got a lot of that firsthand experience of turbulence in a household that it only, that often it only takes one person.
Yeah, I don't desire it. I don't want it. It does not appeal to me. Yeah, I think breaking down chaos has been huge in accepting the fact that I came up in chaos. And then later going to spend time with my mom and seeing that she thrives in chaos. Like when your, you know, mind is always operating a certain way, it becomes comfortable. It becomes just a part of how you think you are, how you think that you need to be or should be. And a part of that for her, I believe, is a bit chaotic. And so spent a good amount of time and energy trying to sort that out for myself because I don't want it.
Do you mind painting a bit of a picture of what things were like around you then leaving home and the kind of contrast with where you grew up to then going off to university?
That's a rough one because my school is a piece of shit. Those people were just as traumatizing as my childhood. Yeah, it wasn't a great environment to be in. So it's like I left one, I won't say, I don't know. It's like I left one thing to end up in another interesting thing. I only have really found peace probably in the past few years, to be honest. That 4 years was not peaceful. And I also, in my third year of college, I had a manic episode. And then I was in the mental hospital. Whoa, how the tables have turned. Yeah, that was all a bit chaotic. And then after that, I was a bit chaotic because I was like, what is this? You know, like, what does this mean? Who am I now? Loads of confusion and shame. So I think it hasn't been until the past few years when I started to look at my parents the way I do with compassion and started to look at myself the way I do with compassion. And I've started to connect the dots between the behaviors that I witnessed and the behaviors that I exhibit. Yeah, it's only been since then that I feel like I've had a sense of actual like calm and well-being.
Yeah, which is great that you've found ways towards that. Could you share a little bit of the events that led up to you going into hospital?
Yeah, so it took a bit of reflection because at the time, my mom was very hardworking. And she's very go, 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 get it done. My understanding of how you're meant to be is go, 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 get it done. It was my understanding. I'm killing that. That's dead to me. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, hey, everybody, nap, nap, nap. It's fine. Like, I'm like, chill out. Just swinging hard the other way. But at the time, I was a full-time student. I worked two jobs. I was a theater performance major, which when you're studying in those departments, like your homework is a bit different. We had to volunteer 6 hours outside of class to the department every week, either doing lighting or the set or costume. And I was also cast in a project that was holding rehearsals. So probably 15 or 18 hours in class. A few more hours spent on that, and then the rest at work. Most days, I was either working or in class from 9 to 9 or 8 to 8. My mom, I think, needed me to pick up the slack financially. So I was trying, but it was just a bit much for me. It was a lot much for me.
That's a lot for anyone. As work, generally, that's a lot.
So my mom, for the past several years, up until recently, she was like a lab technician, something. I never really understand it. Something about petroleum enzymes. It used to be like turbines, sort of wind for jet fuel. I don't fucking know. She's jobs.
Have you just been given words? No one's explained it. They've just given you words.
I'm like, my mom does science. It's true. She does science. And the way that those jobs operate, she's worked 12-hour shifts for the majority of the past 10 years. So my understanding of that 8 to 8, that 9 to 9 is a bit different. If she can do it, I can do it. I fucking couldn't. And I would argue that she shouldn't be.
Yeah. No, I get that. Well, it's a really clear template there, because that is growing up. That's what you've got, is what your parents are doing. That's your first impression of...
Make it happen. Get it done. Let's go. I also must add that I was smoking a shit ton of weed. Adding that to the stress, instead of taking a nap between work and class, I just chill and have a bowl. I was substituting weed for rest.
Ah.
Like, I was like, a nap and a break are the same. So I think that was definitely a factor, like how much I was smoking and the way that I was interacting with that wasn't healthy.
And that's just going to up the strain on you as well, because it might feel like at the time that's easing things, or that's something that's completely separate to your work. But then when you go back to whatever you've got next in your calendar, then you're having to concentrate so much harder to get through it.
Yeah. It's really interesting, because I didn't want that to be a factor, but I have to be honest, it very likely was. And they have this thing they say sometimes in college, you can either have good grades, have a good social life, or rest. It's something like that. And I was like, cool, so we won't rest. Yeah, it was not the move. And I had some friends over, smoking, chatting, having a good old time. And I remember, it was so funny, we went to go see 300. It was the second film of like 300. I don't know why, but I enjoy an action-y time. I'm just like, everyone has blood. Yes, masculinity, let's go. So me and a group of friends went to go see it. We all thought it was pretty cool. Maybe I'm conflating my own excitement with theirs, but we got home and I was like, whoa, I'm thinking so much. That movie has so many elements, and it's hilarious because I had to have been manic because it's not that good. It's not a good film. I was like, oh man, guys, wow, just thinking about that. Oh, I was like, the costume design, wow, that was brilliant. The music, that soundtrack, you know, and in that moment, as I was talking to my friends and we were all kind of gushing about like what we thought was cool about the movie, I felt like I had created IMDb, basically. I was like, let's sort of blog, you guys, where we take a movie and dissect the different parts. You can write about the soundtrack. I can write about like the fashion. Like, it'll be a cool thing. And let me tell you something, okay? They were on board. They were ready to start this website with me. How was I supposed to know that I was a mid-breakdown when everybody was fucking on board? Okay, and then...
Well, if I may add a bit of my own experience from that, I went through a strong phase of spending a lot of time around musical theatre people whilst not being in it myself. And so I'm here to tell you, they're kind of down for anything, and that is part of the problem. So I love that you'd found an environment where you're like, what do I need? Enablers.
They were down. And I was like, so this is a good idea. And one of my friends who was there, who was down for the website.
This feels like you're on trial and you're determined to take everyone down.
Yeah, because I think all of this kind of created a complex around ideas that I didn't realize was happening. Because when you're told about mania, you're told that you come up with these big, big, big grand ideas that can never happen. One of my friends that I was telling this to at the time she knows me, she knew me, she cared about me, and she felt like I wasn't being super coherent, and she felt like I was speaking quite quickly. And she had some knowledge about mental health, and she had met my mom. We went on like a vacation together, so she had her number, and so she called my mom, and my mom got in a car and drove to where I was. And she didn't text me first or call me first. She just showed up. And that was actually really distressing. It was probably 4 or 5 hours later. And it's a 3.5-4 hour drive. So I appreciate that she showed up, but she wasn't helpful. And I didn't realize that a lot of my frustration, confusion, and suffering stems from how I feel about things that she, my father, my stepmother have done, or that I experienced through them, with them. And so when she showed up, I just wanted her to go. It wasn't clear to me, but I just felt stressed out by her presence in that moment. And I was just like, you're making it worse. And I couldn't explain how or why, but I was like, it's worse now. And I don't think she was interacting with me probably in the most healthy way. What it felt like was my energy turned into anger. I was frustrated. You know how your parents can push your buttons? She fucking came holding a remote. She wasn't, there was no de-escalation. There was no creating any sense of calm. I feel like, and this is something I'm still trying to understand, I almost feel like I saw a delight on her face that she saw me now exhibiting behaviors. Oh, you're like me. We're the same. It wasn't helpful. It was infuriating. So I didn't feel like she was like stopping the party. I felt like she was pouring like gas on the fire. And I was just frustrated. And I was like open to the possibility of help. This doesn't feel like help. I feel like you're making this worse. And it was really confusing because I feel like she was trying to do her best, but being the chaotic diva she is, I wasn't ready to receive help from her. And I don't think she was in a great place because seeing me distressed would cause her distress. So now we have two distressed people trying to have an interaction to move something forward.
Yeah, and also she's driven 4 hours in the middle of the night with this on her mind. So she probably came in such a point of action, I need to jump in and fix everything. And for you, yeah, that's received as she's taking all of my autonomy and control, and yeah, I'm meant to be off at uni being an adult. Yeah. And she's just swooped in and taken it.
We all have parents, and like, no one's perfect in the help or relief that they're trying to bring to you. A part of my conflict in it is, while I do appreciate her trying to help, I feel like the way that she went about it exacerbated the issue. And that's what's complicated.
And this is something that I see a lot. My parallel for it would be within like the podcasting and like mental health campaigning world. Oftentimes people can assume that having similar experience is enough to solve somebody else's issues. And
yeah,
first of all, that doesn't make sense. That's an oversimplified idea. But second of all, it can do very much the opposite when someone's trying to jump in and fix somebody else's issues when they've not first done some real work on their own.
That's
and
it.
So I can see That's what you're it. Saying if she came in with none of the tools. You know, her intention may have yeah. been there, but she wasn't very good by the sound of it at dealing with her own stuff. And so dealing with yours,
yeah,
she was going to yeah. struggle with that.
And so what ended up happening was one of the counselors at my university was also just a cool lady. And sometimes I would house sit for her and watch her dog. So I had a relationship, and therefore my mom had a relationship with, you know, a mental health professional at my college already, just through that. So she reached out to her and she pointed her towards the hospital in town. And I can't with the specifics, and I've talked to her about it, and she can't really with them either, which is interesting. It kind of shows that was anybody in their right, you know, state of mind. But we went to the hospital.
And this course, is local? This is in Texas?
Yes. So this is in the same town, Waco. Nothing happens in Waco, but like there was a cult there a long time ago. the Branch Davidians, and they had a shootout with the feds, and that's what happens in Waco.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're not known for their great, you know, mental health care. Tell you that firsthand. So we go to the ER. I'm there. My mom's language feels inflammatory. I'm really upset with her. I can't even focus on what I'm feeling or what I'm going through because I'm really upset with her. You know, mind you, some of the pressure I felt to do all that stuff, that 12 hours, I also attached that to her. Even being told that I needed to get that other job to make more money, that goes back to her. And not saying these things are her fault, but I just felt a lot of anger toward her. Being there, it felt like an escalation. Almost.
Right, well, and because she's part of the stressors that's...
I think I told her, I was like, you stress me out. And she was like, how? I was like, ugh! So we're in the hospital. I remember at one point there was like a thing in my arm so that they could give me stuff, perhaps. So that was in my arm and I felt it and it hurt. That was a fact. I told them, is there something in my arm because it hurt? They said to me, no, there's nothing in your arm. That's fucking with me because I feel it and it hurts. So either this is me being out of my mind too, or you're lying to me, neither of which feels good at all. And you know that...
It's hardly going to help you reconnect with reality. You've got this pain and people are telling you...
No, you don't. Yeah, so from then, it felt like my experience there wasn't largely helpful. You can probably feel it. I still hold a lot of feelings and kind of trauma around this experience because it wasn't positive, it wasn't constructive. And I would argue that, you know, we can't change anything. But I think if we would have went somewhere else, if we got help in Houston, where I'm from, has the biggest and greatest like medical center in the United States. People travel from all over to get help. So there's a lot of great health care going on in Houston. Waco, not so much. So I'm in the hospital. I'm just so upset. I don't know what's going on. No one is being really open with me. I feel like I can't trust these people. And I'm asking what the medications are because I'm like, you're not just going to hand me a pill and I'm going to take it because you work here and I'm nuts. That's not how this is going to go. You're going to tell me what this is that you're telling me to put in my body so I can figure out what the side effects are and things like that because this is weird to me right now. They're upset with me. They're hostile with me for asking. They eventually do give me a pamphlet with the information in a way that's like, they're not happy to give it to me. They're not like, oh, yes. They're not like, oh, yes.
They're so shut her up almost.
Yeah.
And just to check, at this point, were you still voluntary? You weren't under any kind of section?
So this is my understanding of what happened, and I don't know how it's really different here or there, but there were two areas of this hospital. There was like the, I don't know if you call it outpatient or whatever, where like stressed out and like depressed moms would go. It was like the acceptable mental health side. And so when we showed up, it was the weekend, I think, and I wasn't able to go there. And this is my understanding. Admin wise, I wasn't able to go there. My mom was not going to take me home. I was getting in there and I was going somewhere in there because my mom is very, she believes in institutions and she believes in medicine. I would argue more than she should. I believe that medicine can open a door for you to walk through, but it is not the destination. Do you feel me?
I know what you mean. It's a tricky one because there are certain mental health conditions yep. where medication is a big part of a long-term plan. But you're right,
oh, totally.
For many people's cases, medication is part of getting them other help. You know, it's all well and good having really wonderful counselling services, for example. But if somebody's anxiety is so bad,
exactly.
they're struggling to even speak, then
yeah.
there's only so
and
far
you
can go.
I will say, I'm never a person who's like, don't have medicine. I hope to not be on a mood stabilizer my entire life, but I accept that that could be the reality. But the contrast is I see my mom having medications, but not making moves in her life. So I see, you know, my mom having medications, but not picking up exercise or mindfulness. Do you know what I'm saying? So taking the medicine and maybe going to the therapist here and there. But if you're not putting things into practice that you take from therapy or whatever, I don't know. Moral of the story is there's some shit that you gotta do.
I'm very like that, a believer in try multiple routes.
If you see yourself in cycles, or if you see that you have patterns that are causing you suffering, that are causing you distress, if you can intervene, do you know?
And can we just pause actually on the separation? Because that's really interesting what you said about the two sides. So the probably exactly like you say, the outpatients and the inpatient side. Because whilst I don't know as much about how things operate in Texas, that is something that happens quite commonly here, where the higher security wards, because of the type of work they do, they receive emergencies out of hours more so than lower secure wards. And so it makes a lot of sense in terms of when somebody's coming in out of hours, they generally are more of an emergency case. And so they can go into somewhere where people are used to dealing with that day in, day out. The issue can be where somebody isn't in as much of an emergency, but they're placed in a higher ranking just because of when they're admitted. And the other issue with that is we have situations a lot in this country where people go on to higher security wards where most of the people are sectioned, but they're not. But because of how things are operated, if you come in and you're not on a section, you can still be trapped and have your rights restricted in a way that isn't then legal.
Yep. And it was very frustrating. And also it really makes you think about rights and having your, one of my biggest fears to date is having my agency stripped away. Like, I mean, all this stuff around Britney Spears' conservatorship, it hits really hard. It terrifies me, the idea that someone can deem me unfit to whatever and then take all of my agency away, because I felt that a little bit and it was horrible. So even the contrast, because I did end up going over to the day center once they can do the...
Even the thing you mentioned there with Britney, I just want to pause on, because it's incredible to be in a situation where somebody is considered well enough to tour around the globe, but not well enough to access her own bank account.
Yep. It's a fear. It is a fear that I have. And I'm so glad that these conversations around it are happening, because just seeing how, you know, not to say that there aren't times when we are not making the best choices for ourselves. That is a thing for sure. But it's terrifying, the idea that someone can decide that. And like, mental health is so tricky. It's so complicated. Okay, I want to tell you about these two sides, because this was so interesting to me. And it's one of the things that I still like think about and frustrates me. So on the side that I was on, everything was white. It was very sterile. There was nothing stimulating. There was thick plastic instead of glass. There was thick plastic in front of the TV. There weren't books or puzzles. I was allowed to pick one from the other side and then use it. But there was none of that. I ended up giving advice that I shouldn't have gave to a man who had attempted suicide multiple times. And he was, in fact, there on an attempt. Found myself talking to him from being a stranger to when I left. One of our final conversations, I was telling him, and remember, you know, live for your daughter. She loves you. She needs you. Why am I doing that? Why am I having this conversation? The woman who was in my room was pregnant, but going through quite serious drug withdrawal. She was talking a lot at night. It was a lot. There was a man who, I don't know what was going on with him, but he was speaking aloud in three different voices. Two of them were in Spanish. There was a lot. And the one person that I remember that really impacted me and who I was glad I met was, I met another girl from my college. I actually met two. one on the sterile side and one on the fun side. And the girl who was on the sterile side, I was so glad to meet her because she was just stressed out. She was a biology student, and biology is really hard. And, you know, she just had a lot of tests going on and stuff, and she was just stressed out. And she told me, she was like, at one point, I thought I was Jesus, which sounds crazy. Then you factor in the fact that we go to a very heavily religious Christian school where Jesus is always on the brain and where you're taught to be like Jesus, and stuff just starts to make a little more sense. Contrast with the other side, books, puzzles, games, movies, wood stuff. It's not white. Things are like brown now. That's nice. There's art on the walls. It was different. And I wonder how I would view that experience if I was on the side where people were able to have agency, because I am, you know, scarred from that experience, to be honest. It was horrible. And the way that they treated everyone on that side, it was horrible. And I just don't want it for anyone.
Mm, I can see that. And it sounds like in your case, it may have been as simple as if you'd come in on Monday, you would have been.
That's
in
what I was told. But I mean, I really don't want that for anybody. And the way that the people that worked there would speak to me and look at me and treat me, you know, when I was asking for information about treatment, or when I would be able to talk to a counselor, because they weren't working on the weekends either. You know, to the man who told me my diagnosis for the first time and how he delivered that, the coldness and the cruelty that I felt like he wouldn't have used with one of the white moms across the hall with an acceptable depression, you know, like it felt so bad.
Do you remember what he said to you?
Yeah, I'm on this medicine, but I don't really know why. No one will tell me like what it's for. And he goes, well, it's because you're bipolar. And it sounded like that. It felt sharp, which is hilarious because his last name was Bladesdale. And oh, I did not like this man. I have issues with men that look like him. He was so cold and mean. He told, this is the first time I'm hearing this about myself. And it felt like he like punched me with the words, and he was annoyed to be speaking to me.
Yeah, and actually that's a really good point there, because something that's changing a lot, although still a bit too slowly here in the UK, is a move towards person first language. And that's a way to make these things less harsh. So calling you because you're bipolar as if you are your illness, that's kind of the worst end of the spectrum. And then a compromise is a bipolar person, maybe, but even then it's still the condition before you. And then more of what's considered the ideal now is a person with bipolar, or with, who experiences bipolar.
Yeah, you know? And so it was a lot. There was a lot around that that I feel like set me back in my willingness to accept my diagnosis, try to understand it and heal from it and grow through it.
Yeah, because if you're called your condition, it is very difficult to think that there's a way past that.
Yeah, it was very, very weird. So it did take a while after that to be able to accept the diagnosis and to accept treatment by the way of medicine, because I didn't like the way the meds they initially gave me felt. And when I talked to my mom, the only other person I knew that had this or had medicine, she was like, sometimes they don't feel good. And I was worried, and I wasn't like, will I ever be creative again? But at the same time, I wasn't having a lot of fun or funny thoughts. There wasn't a lot of inspiring stuff going on, and I was scared and I hated the medicine. So at one point I think I stopped taking the medicine and that I didn't want it. I think that I one struggled because I wasn't even taking a vitamin every day. So, you know, I then struggled to remember even to take this pill. I'm sorry, I think it was like two pills. Yeah.
Yeah, but even that, you know, not taking it in a regular routine.
Exactly. Yep. And so it was a while before I went to someone, and it wasn't until I sat back, I sat with the feelings, I observed myself for a bit, and I did see the high and low, if you will. Everyone that went to my university takes a strengths finder quiz where you answer like a bunch of questions and it tells you like the five areas that you're like really good at. And mine are around like ideation and connecting with people. And it's true, but for a while, because I was told that bipolar people have huge impossible ideas, I thought that every dream I had was a lie. And that was really hurtful and hard to come back from, to believe in myself enough to do anything that I'm doing. And so at the time, I was coming up with these ideas, which felt like a high place. And I had such energy and motivation to do them. And then that energy and motivation would just go. And that to me felt like a low place. And more than anything, I was tired of letting myself down. So I went to a therapist. It was the first time that I'd ever saw her. She prescribed me the medicine I'm currently on, Lamotrigine. Love it. Also, I find it very interesting that the same medicine used to treat bipolar disorder is also used to treat epilepsy.
It's like actually a lot of drugs where they find they're really useful for things, like Viagra was completely invented by accident. So that was just like a really weird side effect in a drug trial for something else. And then they were like, oh, well, maybe this is useful for this.
They're like, actually, there's a market. Yeah, it's just fascinating to me. But so I went to her, she prescribed me the medication. And when she prescribed me the medication, she also said, by the way, some other things that you can try that will also help. She was trying to level with me. She'd never met me before, or she would have known that I'm totally into it. But she was like, all that hippie shit really works. This is like an older white woman, like, talking to me and, like, you know, my blue hair and 20 whatever year. And she was like, hey, all that hippie shit really works. And I'm like, don't worry, ma'am, I'm into it. But she presented to me not only this medication, but also a kind of more holistic approach. She was like, sleeping well, eating well, you know, these are things that can better your mental health. And maybe at some point further down the line, medication might not be something that you require. She was like, although, you know, that's not the goal. And I was like, thank you. But no one before even said, you feel good when you eat a solid amount. You feel bad when you don't, you know, like even exercise. Exercise is always presented to me as what you do when you're fat. Or you hate your body. Well, I didn't hate my body, so why do I need to exercise? Oh, it makes you feel really good.
And also, it's interesting how when you get into the science of this stuff, it's not actually so separate. You know, like chemical changes happen in your brain from exercise, it releases endorphins. And oftentimes, certain drugs are trying to replicate that. And so it's like, oh, actually, this isn't a hierarchy. You know, maybe at different times in your care, you need certain things more, but actually these can all contribute. And that's been really important for me to learn.
Yeah. Okay. Same. That holistic approach to the thing. Yeah. She's like, hey, by the way. But yeah, I think she was just like, this kid needs to know, and I'm going to try to communicate the best way possible. And I just thought it was kind of cute. And I was like, don't worry, girl, I'm with you. And until I found someone that could hook me up with a prescription here, she sent me an online prescription from the States. And I would say that I wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't made that move or made my mental health a priority before leaving the States. I'd probably be somewhere like doing a shit ton of Molly. Because that's what I was doing at the time.
You know, you were in a situation where you weren't coping and people will have been around you saying this will relax you and you think, well, I need relaxing.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. And like not knowing how to make it better, because I, especially who I am today, it's hard sometimes to execute, but I want to know how to make things better so that I can try. And I do believe that I was that person then. I didn't know what to do and I couldn't think straight. I couldn't think straight to figure it out.
And that's so true, because so often when we're in a very dark place, it's survival. Getting to the next day is about all we can comprehend. And even then, that can be difficult. And so I'm so glad that you did get the support.
Yeah, and honestly, reclaiming belief in myself was huge. It was huge. Like, I can't even stress the thing around, yeah, ideas. I don't know, because I think when you're told that people like you frequently come up with things that they could never accomplish,
It's a really tricky one, and I think possibly made harder by mania is partly characterized by being in a mental space where your optimism is kind of off the charts, and that removes you from reality. And that is then completely contrasted with the depression periods. And so the condition isn't just bad in terms of the two sides causing their own problems, but it's also the contrast.
And the fear of the two sides coming and get you.
Yeah. And so a lot of the time in care around this, people try and really encourage you to not associate with the sides, right? Because the inclination would be, well, the highs feel better, so that's the version of me that I want to be.
I didn't glamorize or enjoy mania. It felt like a lot of anxiety and a lot of energy, especially once I was aware of it. So I never craved that manic state, but just being told that I am a person and inclined to come up with things that can't happen made it hard for me to imagine myself as a comedian. It made it hard for me to believe that that was even possible. Or when I come up with an idea for, you know, the Films of Color Comedy Club, is that too big? Is that crazy? When I come up with a TV format, is that too big? Is that crazy? And literally that question has haunted so many things. Moving to the UK, is that crazy? Moving to LA before that, that's probably too big. So just that fear, I've had to reclaim my ability to imagine and dream things for myself. I felt like that was probably a symptom. I felt like my goals were a symptom, you know?
I can see why, and I'm so glad you've got to the place where you can figure so much of that out. And so as we start to round up, do you mind sharing a bit of what combination of things support your mental health now?
Yeah, I'm trying to exercise more, but it's hard. It's never been like a part of my thing, but I know that it's good or whatever. So trying to do that. And I think journaling has been huge. Getting to know my inner critic has been huge. She stresses me out. And drawing connections, I think the biggest thing, because everything else has stemmed from that. Sitting down, facing your history, facing your childhood and your adolescence as a part of your evolution and not as some kind of separate time or some kind of different person. That was still you, as in those experiences and those things have impacted and do influence the way that you move today. And in which ways is that helpful? In which ways is that harmful? I think looking at my history and using that to understand my present has been the most transformative thing. And it's allowed me to say, okay, I get really bad social anxiety because my step-siblings never treated me like their sister. Okay, so now when those feelings of wanting to belong and be included come up, you know, it's easier to understand and navigate them because I know where they came from. You know, I create emergencies where there aren't any. So does my mom. And everything has to be now, now, now. But wait, actually it doesn't. Okay, so figuring out, yeah, where things have come from has been huge for me.
I love that. The same for me, actually. Certain situations I find myself in where I used to feel really overwhelmed, my mood would just totally plummet and not knowing why, you know, and that's why sometimes, particularly with the stigma that's so pervasive, it is easy at times to write yourself off as I'm crazy or I'm being crazy right now. And actually, like you say, digging into what's really happening, I can be like, oh, okay, I'm reacting so strongly because this is pulling in feelings of the past. It's not that I'm overreacting. I'm just reacting to this situation and something else. So I'll bring the something else to my counsellor. That's been massive. Yeah. And I also love what you said about coming to terms with the person that you were, you know, accepting two things, accepting the person that you were and the situation you were in and some of the decisions that may have made sense at the time, even if they don't now, but then also accepting that you don't have to be that person forever. You know, you can be cool with them and also want to move on from that version of yourself.
And also, like, what did they need as well? Because that's likely what you need. I needed someone to provide me with a little structure and a bit of protection. And so now I have to learn how to build structure for myself and also how to protect myself. And I feel better for it, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. All right. So we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for sharing so openly. Yeah. If people want to find more of your work, where should they go?
Instagram, on the Twitter. Yeah, I put stuff there. And I'm hoping to launch a podcast around spirituality in the next year and just kind of in a very accessible way. So keep an ear out for that. Because I think during lockdown, a lot of people have had more time to get in touch with themselves. And I just like to encourage that because I think that's what we need.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.